probably the theory of evolution is going to be remembered in history of science as one of the most important ideas to have gotten into the intellectual history of man. The reason for that is, as one author has noted, is that there's no other intellectual revolution in modern times, with the possible exception of the Copernican, which was the idea, basically the shift from the sun going around the earth to the earth going around the sun. That revolution in scientific thinking has so profoundly affected the way that men viewed themselves and their place in the universe. Basically, what evolution did in man's thinking was replace the idea of a designer, of a creator out there having fashioned the world that we see, replace that design feature with the idea of chance. As one author has said, it replaced the idea of a creator God with a pair of dice that were only here as a result of a chance interaction of some molecules. There's no meaning for us to be here other than that, and therefore the whole idea of God can be dismissed from the scene. And that's basically what many people have done. Since science has a model for explaining how we got here without evoking God, then if science doesn't need God, then we don't need God either in our lives. And thus this has been used as a convenient rationale for dismissing God from men's lives. But, as has been noted here by another author, I'm quoting here fairly extensively from a book by Denton, D-E-N-T-O-N, The Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, which the seminary library has. He notes, though, that the idea of changing one's interpretation of the world is not the same as establishing a new fact. Basically pointing out something that we've seen in optical illusions and basic drawings from Escher and things like that, that there are times when you can represent the data, you can have a set of data that can be viewed in two different ways. You can either see this drawing as an old woman here with a shawl on, or as a young woman looking off here to the side, depending upon the way you view the various features. So again, just because men think of a new way to view the data does not necessarily mean that they've established a new fact about the way the universe actually is. So this is something which we're going to be looking at tonight. Now, so the main question then, as we're going to be focusing on, is evolution really true? Is it confirmed to the point that many people would say that we can totally dismiss the idea of a God? Is it so firmly established as a fact? And there's many people who would try to intimidate us into investigating this topic by saying, look, Nobel laureate scientists and all kinds of other people agree that it's thoroughly established as true. But this is a quotation from Francis Crick, who was one of the men who deciphered the structure of the basic DNA molecule, and also won the Nobel Prize for it. Where he basically says that an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, can only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it going. So there are men out there who hold to evolution, but realize that the fact that it occurred, or the idea that it occurred, is, you know, almost miraculous. It's almost impossible that given the present mechanisms that they have for it, that it could have happened. So we're not being unreasonable scientifically to be saying, well, just how solid is this evidence that is often presented for proving evolution? And, you know, is it so solidly established that we can, you know, throw God out of the picture as a creator? So this is what I would like to look at. To get into the subject, though, we need to start off with definitions and distinctions, because the words that you use here are very, very tricky that we work with. First of all, the most general definition, when a biologist refers to evolution, He means the following, that there's a basic change in the genetic makeup of a population with time. There's nothing about origins here or anything like that in the most basic definition of evolution that you will find in a biology textbook. It's basically change. It's what they mean by evolution. This is something that we see all the time. For example, bacteria developing resistance to penicillin, for example, and some of these other antibodies. This is what they mean, that an organism will develop the ability to react to its environment, and thus its genetic information that carries with it will change over time. And this is something which we really, you know, if this were all they meant by evolution, we wouldn't be here, because this is very easily demonstrated, is very true, and really isn't very threatening to Christianity either, because it's something that we observe. In fact, it's even in the Bible. If you have various races of men coming from Adam and Eve, the various colorations in skin and the other facial features that differ is a basic idea of change in genetic makeup of a population with time. It's, you know, very sort of biblical concept in that sense. But when they want to get technical about the working with evolution and biological animals and things, they break this general notion into two basic words, one would say, two basic concepts. And this is where your textbooks are very deceptive. They will not make the distinctions that I'm going to make here, which any scientist working in the field would. They blur together the following things and make it all sound true and all sound established. The first breakdown that they will make is microevolution. And the basic definition here is that new races and species arise in nature by the agency of natural selection. This is what Darwin spent most of his time working on in his book, The Origin of Species. His basic mechanism for this was what he would call mutation, which is, again, a change in the genetic information that a cell carries with it, an animal carries in its cells over its lifetime, and passes on to its offspring. A change in that information by some random means, be it radiation damage or copying error or something like that, occurs. And that produces, that mutation produces some small change in the animal, which is either favorable to its existence, doesn't make any difference, or is detrimental to it and makes it harder for it to live. So then he has a selection process of these mutations, which he calls survival of the fittest, in which the mutation which, given that one occurs, the mutation which is most favorable for the animal allows that animal to survive and produce more offspring, and that then becomes a dominant trait in that line of animals. So this is basically the mechanism of microevolution. If you carry this process out long enough with small changes, we will see new species develop. What a biologist means by a species is an animal that is sexually isolated from the other animals around it. For example, what was my good example of this? Oh, I forget. Dogs, for example, are not an example of that because they can interbreed with each other. Cats are the same way. But squirrels and frogs can have, although they look very similar, there are various types of squirrels that cannot interbreed with each other. If they do, they do not produce offspring, or they don't produce fertile offspring, and thus, you know, it's not a useful thing for them to be doing. So basically, new species are the end result of microevolution. New animals which are sexually isolated from other ones and can preserve their characteristics onto their offspring. This general mechanism here, again, in microevolution, is one that is very valid. It's one that anyone who breeds plants and animals and raises roses or animals in any way is familiar with and works with quite a bit. One of the things that Darwin noted in his work was the domestication of the pigeon. I hope this shows up fairly well. It's not too bad. But the basic rock dove, which is found in the cliffs in Wales, has been bred not only in Center City, Philadelphia, into the forms that you see around, but has been bred into many various beautiful types of pigeons, which, for man's basic purpose for beauty. So this type of development of new types of animals is one of the things of microevolution. The So man can do it himself to animals that he breeds, but it appears that this type of phenomena happens in nature as well. Darwin, when he went to some of the islands off the coast of South America, discovered a set of birds on the Galapagos Islands, which have since been called Darwin's finches. The islands are far enough off the coast that birds just can't fly out there routinely, and apparently some original ancestor was blown out there by a storm or some other means at one time, but has since diverged into several different types of finches with different coloration, with different diets, different beak structures, reflecting the different dyes that they have. One of them has even learned to use tools for picking insects out of holes in the bark and things like that. This type of small changes occurring in an animal to produce a new species is something which seems to be very well documented. It's been done essentially in the laboratory, and it can be validated in existing animals, and man can breed them in that direction by the same mechanisms. So microevolution, again, if that's all that was being meant by the theory of evolution, would not be a problem. We wouldn't be here tonight. But, and as a matter of fact, if you want to fit this into the biblical model, I would say this fits into God's decree to man to control nature, to master nature by having dominion over it. There's a certain flexibility there in animals, like there is in plants, that allows them to breed plants to produce, you know, better varieties of corn and wheat and better varieties of livestock. This is the flexibility there in the genetic information, which is microevolution, which God has put there for man to use. But the real kicker comes in the second division of evolution, which is made, which is called macroevolution, big evolution. The idea here is that all life on Earth arose by an extension of this above mechanism, the one we were just talking about. And again, what they would say then is that all changes occur by this natural selection of small, single mutations. So what they have in mind here is this basic idea, and you've seen this before. The idea that we started off with some type of primitive fish, which then evolved into fishes with bones in their jaws, and then boneless fish in the jaws, which turned into sharks. The bony fish turned into some sort of pre-amphibian, an advanced amphibian, then we went from there to reptiles. Reptiles branched off into mammals and birds. This is macroevolution, this formation of not just new species, but whole new orders and classes of animals that are radically different from each other. The development of new organs, feathers and hair, scales, gills turning into lungs, this whole huge type of changes is what they would call macroevolution. This is the kind of thing that has not been observed. And in fact, when challenged about it, they would say that it cannot be observed because it takes millions of years for these processes to work themselves out. You can't have a laboratory experiment that lasts millions of years. So that's one of the basic problems with it. But what that does as a scientist is that throws you out of the realm of a nice laboratory system, which is, as a chemist and a physical scientist in physics, those are the systems where you can set them up and reproduce them time after time, juggle the conditions a little bit and see what happens. That's a nice, solid, classical art science. What that turns evolution into is what we would call a historical problem. We can't reproduce it in the lab. We have to go out and look for evidence in existing life forms and in fossils for whether or not this has occurred. We can't test to see if it actually can happen in the laboratory ourselves. So this becomes a historical problem. There's a great difference in the level of certainty you can have between a laboratory experiment that you can set up and a historical problem because of that irreproducibility in history. So there's a shift there being made in the science that's being done. There can be very valid scientific history studies made, but there is a shift there being done in the type of science that you're doing. So what we're going to look at, again, is not the problems in this microevolution, the new species being formed, but we're going to look at the problems in the macroevolution, that we can explain the whole origin of life by an extension of microevolution. You know, I said here that it hadn't been observed. You know, what no one has found yet is this sort of thing. No man has wandered along the beach and seen some squiggles come up on the shore and gradually develop some feet, and then those feet gradually become more human-like and it walks off up the beach. This is not the kind of thing which is observed in macroevolution. If it were, we probably wouldn't be here again. So this is the type of thing that is not found. They'd like to, perhaps, but isn't there. So what we're going to look at in now are the problems of that evolutionary theory. And the major problem I'm going to spend most of the time on is this extrapolation idea. That the biggest problem with evolution is that we're extrapolating from we're extrapolating from the microevolution to the macroevolution level. The reason that's a dangerous extrapolation to make is because in other natural sciences we find that there's limits to a mechanism that we might have. There's limits to how far we can extrapolate something. For example, if we're working with weather, meteorology, if we have a barometer, that can give us 6 to 12, maybe a couple day prediction as to what the weather is going to be like. We have barometers and wind direction and things like that, and some experience as to what the weather patterns are in our area. And if we have some knowledge of the seasons, that can give us a prediction of what it's going to basically be like a year from now, a couple years from now, in terms of the weather. But if we try extrapolating out to trying to predict ice ages or explain ice ages, we can't do that with barometers and all that easily with Earth orbiting simply around the sun. There's new mechanisms that come into play when we go over a long time scale and trying to predict the weather. And thus, to say that there might be limits to a biological model, isn't all that out to lunch if there's limits in other fields. Again, in geology, we can explain a lot of surface features on the Earth by evoking volcanoes and studying erosion, looking at upheaval of the Earth to form mountain ranges, requiring great lengths of time for the erosion to occur. But for some things, you have to jump and go to continental drift to explain some of the layout of the ocean floors and the arrangement of the continents. So there's a limit to how far we can push a volcanic mechanism to explain all the features that we see on the Earth. Similarly, in physics, we have very severe problems if we try to take Newtonian mechanics, which is the kind of things that an engineer uses in designing cars and so on. If you try to apply that in small dimensions at the atomic level, it completely falls apart because we're working with what they call quantized units of mass and energy, and it just doesn't work. Newtonian mechanics breaks down. Similarly, if we try going at high speeds, not those you go in your car, but up near the speed of light, again, Newtonian mechanics breaks down. There's a limit to how far you can extrapolate various mechanisms because of other constraints that come into play. So again, if it happens in other sciences, for us to allow ourselves the freedom to just extrapolate microevolution infinitely to account for all life here is a very dangerous thing to be doing because we can't do it in other sciences. We can't extrapolate like that. So it's one thing to say in theory that there are limits to how far we might be able to go, but let's look for some evidence that would show us that there might be limits to how far we can extrapolate microevolution. The first evidence of a limit that I'd like to look at is what I would call modern taxonomy. This is the classifying of animals into various types, like we have birds and reptiles and mammals and fish, these various breakdowns and categories. And what a good taxonomist can do is he can take about 99% of the animals that are in existence or have existed, and he can classify them by their physical features into well-defined categories. The kind of thing you might have seen this done in is when he's working with carnivorous animals, for example. And he can say, okay, now there's two different types of carnivorous animals. There's the kind that are sort of dog-like, that's what's behind the Latin here, and kind of cat-like. And we can break them down into a cat, into a dog type, and a fox type, and a small cat type, and a large cat type. And then we can finally lump these various animals into lions and tigers into this large type, cats and ocelots into the smaller type, foxes and dogs and wolves into this other type. He can form distinct classes of animals by looking at the various features that these animals have. And that type of thing is not what we would predict that we could do if evolution were true. So if evolution were true and animals are changing from one form to another by a series of small single mutations, stepwise going from one form to another, you wouldn't expect to see these very distinct classes. And you can look at a dog and tell it's a dog. You can look at a bird and tell it's a bird. You don't have dogs running around with feathers and trying to fly and this kind of thing. The fact that there are these distinctions between animals and that there's not thousands of intermediate forms running around blurring these categories implies that this idea of making transitions by small changes from one animal to the next is not something that they observe in taxonomy. Just to show you how detailed this breakdown can be, if we look at the differences between reptiles and mammals, for example, the categories here, this is from a 1986 book on mammal evolution from the reptiles, they give us some of the criteria. For example, here you have scale-covered skin versus hair-covered skin. There's no external ear on a reptile, where a mammal will have some ear projection around it. Reptiles lay eggs, mammals don't. Their young are developed inside. And taxonomists can come up with quite an extensive series of criteria that it can use for looking at an animal and saying, well, this is a mammal type and this is a reptile type. And this even carries on into skeletal features, which when they're studying fossils, they can look at a bone and say, well, what animal did this come from? So these type of criteria are something which, if this idea of small mutations causing the transitions, small changes in the animal over time, we wouldn't expect to find such clear distinctions here of reptile, mammal, and nothing really in between. It's that gap that is the problem. So what we tend to find here is what's been called typology, where instead of seeing a blur of features among animals, we see that there's variations on what they would call a basic theme. For example, the mammal type. We can say all mammals have ears, hair, nurse or young, and a series of other criteria there that we were looking at, where no other animal has those features. Other than mammals, there's no other animals that have hair, for example, and that kind of thing. So in a typological approach, a mouse is as good a representative of a mammal as a human is, or as a dog is, because you've found these basic features which are distinctive for a mammal and which distinguish it from reptiles and fish and birds. So you can make, in a sense, little circles which have all mammalian features, all reptile features, all fish features, but there is nothing in between them. There's not these animals around that blur those distinctive categories that you can make. It's sort of like in geometry, you can come up with basic definitions for triangles and rectangles and other geometric figures. And, there's some triangles that look like they might be pretty close to a rectangle, but they're not because they only have three straight sides and three angles in their closed figure, as opposed to four angles and four straight sides. So as in geometry, we can class geometric figures in various ways. It looks like we can do the same basic thing with animals. And the fact that there aren't these transitions in between is a great problem for this small change idea. Now, I said 99% because there's about 1% of the animals out there which are weird, basically. There's an animal called a lungfish, which has been around for a couple hundred million years, which has a reptilian-type lung, but it has, fins and scales and that kind of thing like a fish does. And the platypus is, a very common example. It has a duck bill, it lays eggs like a reptile, yet it has hair. and I think it nurses its young after they hatch. You know, it does these weird things. But those are as much a problem for an evolutionist to worry about as they are for someone who's approaching it from a typological approach, because these, what they might call transition form, has modern features. In other words, a platypus has modern reptile legs that it lays, and nurses its young like a modern mammal does and has modern hair. It doesn't have what you might call proto-hair, primitive hair, or some primitive egg structure to it or something like that. So it's a mix of modern features, but not features that you can say, aha, this is primitive. This is a definite proof of bridging this gap between mammal and reptile. But there's a couple animals out there that are weird, but they're not really that helpful for either model, in a sense. There's a couple anomalies. So the fact that we can end up with 99% of the animals classified this way with such large gaps between them is a problem, then, for the evolutionary approach. And an occasional transition form, in a sense, only accentuates that. Because if there's only a dozen of those, when there should be thousands of them, if this small changes idea is true, then, you know, then where are the other 9,996 life forms to prove their model? What they would have to say, then, if evolution is true, that none of these ancestral or primitive transition forms has survived until today. The reason there are these gaps there today is because the animals that bridged those gaps have died out. And that's something, then, where we have to appeal to the fossil record, then, to look for. Another basic problem with evolution is what we would call homology. Homology is the basically the idea that a basic structure in an animal is used to do different things by different animals. The most famous idea here is the forelimb of an animal, where they basically see a five-finger model in all kinds of animals here. You go, a five-fingered structure is used in a bat for flying. It's used in a human hand. It's used in the cat for walking. It's used in a bird for flying. It's used in the turtle for swimming. And then the seal as a flipper. The only real difference you see is some animals have learned to walk on their toenails or on their toes, and this is the horse and the sheep category, where, if evolution is right, it took 60 million years to lose some of these extra fingers and develop the one toe. But the fact that this type of design is conserved, you know, and used for so many different purposes is what they call homology. And Darwin considered this the strongest argument that he had at the time for proof that evolution was true. And I would say it's a very strong argument indeed that microevolution is true, that a basic structure can be adapted by different forms to do different things. But it also shows that there's a limitation to that change, and that's what we're looking at here. Why is it that the bat is stuck with five fingers there in its wing? Why hasn't it developed a sixth one or dropped one or two of them to make a better wing? Is that, in principle, the best wing structure that a bat could have? So there's this fixity of five appearing for all these different forms shows some change, but it also shows a limitation to what can occur out there in change. And it's that limitation which poses the problems. The animal can't change it at will, or if nature or whatever can't change it at will, then, you know, what exactly is going on? Can we say then that, because this is quite a huge difference, you had to go from some paw to a wing for the structure and yet retain five fingers, shows that there's something there that can't change even though these other things are changing. So there's limitations to it. So what we see then here again is that idea of limitation to changeability. I spelled changeability wrong if you're a grammar person, so I apologize for that. I have to rework this one. But again, it's proof that there is change, that the microevolution, that some change can occur, but it shows that there's a limitation to it. And thus, you know, how far can we extrapolate microevolution then? The third problem, in terms of a limitation, is the fossil record itself. And here's where we see, again, this lack of transition forms. Remember I'd said earlier that if evolution were true, we'd expect to see thousands of these forms in transition from reptile up to mammal, because a small change, these changes are occurring, an individual mutation at a time, those have to build up in the animal, and you have to have living animals going from one to the other, so one would expect to see quite a blur of features somewhere out there in going from reptiles to mammals or something like that, or in any of the changes that we'd want to see. But again, in the fossil record, we don't find any. And you don't have to disbelieve me on that, because I have a couple of citations here. George Gaylord Simpson, who is probably one of the greatest paleontologists of the 20th century, wrote in his book here, Tempo and Mode in Evolution, about this absence of transition forms. So it says here, the regular absence of transitional forms is not confined to mammals, but is an almost universal phenomenon. This has long been noted by paleontologists. It's true of almost all orders of all classes of animals, both vertebrate and invertebrate. Then he goes on here and says that it's also true of many analogous categories of plants. So, just to show you the type of drawing here that he would make for showing the evolution of animals, of mammals from reptiles, he has some blurry type of reptiles here, some evidence for them if they're shaded. And then this huge gap where he has to make these dotted lines to connect from one animal form to the other, and there's, as he calls it, a systematic deficiency of the record in doing those transitions. What they tend to find here is that some animal will appear on the scene just kind of suddenly on the fossil record, full form, advanced form, one would say, and goes on without really doing very much change over the length of time that they have the fossils for it, unless it happens to die out. But these transitions from one mammal form to the other, or from reptiles to mammals, aren't there. And this is a paleontologist who's recognized as one of the best that there is in this century. So there are gaps out there exactly where one would like to not have them if one were in evolutionist. This citation here is from Norman Burrell in a book, The Origin of Vertebrates, where he basically discusses the evolution of this. And this is kind of an interesting quote here. He says, there's no direct proof or evidence that any of the suggested events or changes ever took place. This is in his introduction to his book. What strength the argument may have comes only from whatever well circumstantial detail I have been able to muster. In a sense, this account is science fiction, but I myself have found it an interesting and enjoyable venture to speculate concerning the Cambrian and Precambrian happenings that may have led to my own existence. Okay, so he's calling his whole book basically science fiction. He has no solid evidence for what he's about to undertake. And then he goes, bears the soul, and might say, one step further. This is great. It says, in these days of projected travel to the moon and Mars, I find a speculative journey into time more comfortable and less nightmarish form of escape from the inquietude of our present civilization. So for him, toying with evolution is a form of escapism. Now, you know, these same people will turn around and criticize Christians for being escapist and needing a crutch and hoping for pie in the sky by and by. And yet, here's a guy who tinkers with evolution and writes books about it as speculative journeys that are a form of escape from the inquietude of our present civilization. So it's like, you know, blew my mind when I read that. But, so, you know, these are guys that in, when there aren't Christians around threatening their model and things like that, will say, we're really speculating here about this, and the data is very, very conjectural. So, those are, you know, the kind of things that we have going on. So there are these lack of transition forms out there. Now we do see, you know, if we look at the fossil record, there is an improvement. We find single-celled, simple sponge-like animals and things like that, in the earliest rocks, and then we find reptiles appearing and then mammals appearing. You know, we do find this kind of improvement from simple to complex, but it's the intermediates between these life forms that are very rare or not there, or totally absent in that sense. And again, as I was pointing out, you get these distinctive classes appearing abruptly in the record. A new mammal shows up, poof, out of nothing in a sense, as far as the fossil records is concerned. And you even get modern forms that appear. And this is what's, in a sense, striking. You'll find bats and cockroaches in the fossil record going back millions of years. And the fossil of the cockroach looks exactly like the modern cockroach that you step on in your apartment. And it's been running around eating things for millions of years without changing, which is a shock, in a sense, to the evolution idea. Well, there are some transitional forms out there that we see paraded in textbooks all the time. And I'd like to look at two of the real famous ones here. The one is horse. Basically, you've probably seen this kind of thing, where they, if you go to the Museum of Natural History in New York City, you'll see the original display of this. They basically have arranged a series of horse-like fossils by size. And it happens that that size arrangement works out fairly well over time also. You've got a four-toed animal that drops to three toes, the toe shrinks, and then turns into basically a one-toed horse, and the modern horse comes out of it. Now, I think on its own grounds, this arrangement of these animals could be attacked and said this is just a fortuitous arrangement of the fossils. But what I'd like to do is go at it in a different way. If I can find my original overhead. Here it is. Let's say that that is true, and that that fossil record arranging it that way is really correct. Well, then what we've seen happen in the fossil record is that over the course of 60 million years, we've seen a small horse-like animal turn into a modern horse. And biologically, that's gone through 10 genera. Those are different categories of animals, and many different species to get there. Well, if we have evidence for that, then where's the evidence for bigger changes that occurred supposedly in the mammals as well? Like that similar small animal turning into a whale. Where are the transition forms that go from a small land mammal to a male? So in a sense, what we're doing, if we're pulling up the horse and saying this is a nice valid series of fossils connecting them, we're using an exception to prove a rule. Okay, if you only have one transition form that you can wave, and yet there should be thousands of these types of transition forms out there, you're only, in a sense, accentuating the weakness in the argument by stressing the one so much. And I think that's a valid point to be making. Yeah, okay, they can do it for the horse, but what about all the other transitions that should have occurred? Where's the transitions from a small mouse-like animal to a bat? From a small land mammal to a whale, where the thing goes back into the water? Where are all the other transition forms that should be there? So, you know, if we're looking at these showcase examples, they're glaring because of the few numbers of them that we actually have. So that's the one problem with the horse. We have the horse, whereas everything else that was making far greater changes over that same length of time than the other. The other showcase example is the Archaeopteryx. This is the primitive bird, is what it would be called. What they look at here is some fossils found in Germany about 100 years ago, where they found a very bird-like animal with feathers. These feathers were really in the rocks. But it has claws on the wings, it has teeth on the jaw, and it has a very long tail for bird. And they say, aha, these features here, the teeth and the claws and the tail like this, what we would call reptilian features. And this animal here then shows us a nice true transition form between a pure reptile, which wouldn't have feathers, wouldn't have a wishbone. There's a couple of, the feathers, the wishbone, some of the other things here, and a reptile. It's right in between. Very nice. Well, there's a problem here with what we classify as reptilian and what we classify as bird-like features. For example, the claws are not strictly reptilian. There are some birds out there that have them. There's a Hoitzen, which is a bird in South America, which has claws on its wings and can fly. And the ostrich has claws. It's in Africa. Now, it doesn't fly, but again, it's a bird. It has the feathers and everything else. So it might be a rare feature for a bird, but it's a bird feature that's found in living bird forms. The particularly long tail here with the vertebrate is a little bit unusual. This swan has a much shorter tail, but it has a quite a bony tail compared to many other birds. It's not quite as long as the Archaeopteryx, but it's that type of unusual feature compared to other birds. Teeth are an interesting problem because no modern birds have teeth. But Mesozoic birds going back 30 to 40 million years, some of those did. So we have to say, you know, these features that are supposed to make it a transitional form, are they really that distinctive as a reptilian feature? And there's many people who study birds that would look at this thing and say, no, look at the crazy thing. It's got a wishbone, it's got good feathers, it can fly, it's a bird with a couple of weird things in it. So it's that type of problem that we're working with. This whole problem with Archaeopteryx has been made a lot stickier here because last summer they discovered another bird which is 75 million years older than the Archaeopteryx. And it has features which are more advanced than the Archaeopteryx has. It has claws, but it doesn't have teeth in the jaw. It has a much more bird-like skull, has a wishbone and so on, but it also has the long tail on it. So again, here's a bird that's 75 million years older, which is more advanced than the Archaeopteryx, which is later in time. So what they say now is that the Archaeopteryx is probably some dead end or some rare type of bird form that went extinct in time, and this is more representative of the more modern bird line that we see now. So that's one of the problems with it. Where most of these transition forms seem to appear is not in the fossil record, but in the creative hands of the artists that are drawing the pictures that one sees in textbooks. And this happens to be a nice example of it. Notice here that this is a 75 million year older fossil. So what we're going to do here is we're going to make the feathers on the wings a little bit smaller so it doesn't really look like it can fly all that well. We're not going to put any feathers on the tail here because that would obviously be a bird-like creature and confuse it. So when you look at what's done in the artistry in presenting these animals, that's where most of the transition forms appear. If you take the now the Archaeopteryx is nice because the feathers were really found in the rocks, but that's one of the problems. If you draw it right, you can make it look a little bit more transitional. But if they put full feathers on this and feather the tail, this thing would look, you know, as nice as the swan does or something like that today, except for the claws on it. So, you know, these are some of the problems that we're working with transitional forms. There are only one or two nice examples of them out there, and they're embellished with the right type of artistry to make them look good, and that's about it. And yet we would expect, if evolution were true, that there would be thousands of these things out there. But how do they explain the gaps in the fossil record that they find, that you find these new species appearing abruptly? They'll say, first of all, this is Darwin's main argument, that there's been insufficient research done. We just haven't looked at all the fossil beds and all the bones out there, and that's why there's these gaps. But that was 100 years ago, and men have been looking in these rocks for 100 years and pulling fossils out of them, and yet these gaps that Darwin saw were there, which Darwin said if those gaps stayed there would be the death of his theory, those gaps are still there 100 years later, and they've been working on. The other thing that one would say is that there's an imperfection in the record and that some of these forms, these transitional forms, didn't live in large numbers, and they lived in areas where the fossils, their bones would not be well preserved as fossils, and therefore we don't see them very well. The problem with that is that about 80% of the present living life forms that we have on Earth now are preserved in the fossil record in a good form. So if 80% of the known animals exist in fossils, then one would expect that 80% of these transition forms, if they existed, should be out there somewhere as well. So the statistics are working against them in the imperfection of the record. So what they would finally say then is that there's jumps occurring in evolution. That evolution doesn't occur in these small transitional forms, one change at a time, that you'll get big jumps in them. A group of kangaroos will go off on vacation, you know, from the main herd for a while off in the mountains, and they come back in a few hundred thousand years as people walking around or something like that. But a small group will undergo a massive jumps in their evolutionary cycle in a small period of time. And the idea in this is what they would call punctuated equilibrium. The idea that things stay stable for a long period of time, and then a change occurs over the course of, you know, very short time geologically to make these new animals. The problem with that is that there's no genetic mechanism that can account for that type of mutation rate occurring and stabilizing and then being stable for a while. So although it's kicked around, the recognition of these gaps in the fossil record, there's no good model to explain it from the evolutionary standpoint. So the real problem that we get down to is that there's fewer transitional fossil species between major divisions than between minor ones. Okay, this is like the horse and the whale thing. We're looking at a minor division, we're looking at small changes in an animal, we get fossils, we get fossils that can show some development of new species of cockroaches and that kind of thing. But if we're going for a big jump in the fossil record, this land mammal turning back into a whale or something like that, that's where the gaps are. And that's exactly where one would not want them to be in an evolutionary model, because there should have been more transitional forms between the big jumps than there are between the small ones. But that's exactly the opposite of what we found. The last thing here to look at in terms of a problem from this limitations to microevolution is in molecular biology. Biochemists have been able to do here in the past 20 years or so is to study the proteins in various animals. And the famous one that they enjoy looking at is what's called cytochrome C. Any animal or yeast or cell that breathes air has cytochrome C in it. So you can go from yeast all the way up to humans, and this molecule, the same basic molecule, was in it. Just to show you here what it looks like, each one of these bars is an amino acid. Okay, normally we're used to thinking of them as an atom. Each one of these is an amino acid, and I can't really quite get the whole thing in here, but we'll try. In the center here is a group which binds, that carries an electron, that takes an electron from one enzyme, passes it through the cell to another enzyme which takes that electron away from it, and this thing goes back. So this whole molecule is basically a shuttle bus carrying electrons back and forth, burning oxygen in your body. And the red molecules here, or the red amino acids here, are ones which, doesn't matter whether it's a yeast or human, it's exactly the same amino acid. That amino acid seems to be required to be of that type for that enzyme to do its thing. But there's other amino acids out there, and these are the purple ones and the blue ones, depending upon how much they can change, which don't seem to affect its function, and thus they change depending on whether it's a yeast or a human or a monkey or anything in between. So by studying these molecules that change and how much they change, they thought they could get a very good handle on evolution. What Pauling and some of the first men that thought of this were hoping to see was this type of thing. We would see in a very primitive lamprey cyclostome animal, kind of a pre-fish, a certain amino acid sequence in its cytochrome C. And some of these amino acids would change in the course of making the transition to the fish, but some of them would stay the same. D would stay the same, the Q would change to B, and so on. Then when the transition is made from fish to amphibian, again, some of them would change, but some of them would stay the same, and so on up the line. And what they were hoping to be able to do was to string together a nice chain showing the evolution of this amino acid, of this enzyme, by showing how some amino acids changed and some didn't, and one would be able to basically link them together from human all the way back down to yeast or whatever was the first thing out there, showing the sequence. Turns out it ain't that easy, basically. And what they have, how they've been able to do it, that type of nice causal link they haven't been able to show, easily. But what they've been able to do, so what they've done with the data, is classified it according to the percentage of difference in the amino acids between two different types of animals. So if you look here, this is hard to see, I know, but between a dog and a human, there's an 11% difference in the amino acids in cytochrome C from the dog to the human. This is like a road map that shows you the mileage from Philadelphia to Washington. So it has the dog to human, and then it also has a human to dog. So it's kind of symmetric about this zero line here. And they basically classified them that way. And if we look at a chain here coming down, it looks very nice. I mean, humans are most like humans, so that's really good to know. And then we go here from human to monkey, and there's a slight change. We come down to pigs, there's a bigger change. And you change when you go to birds, it gets bigger. Fish, it gets bigger. Insects, it gets even bigger, and so on down the line. If we look down one column of this chart, we see that the further you get away from humans, the bigger the differences are. And that's the type that is the way this data is represented in a introductory level biology biology textbook. They'll say human beings and chimpanzees do not differ at all. Both differ by one amino acid from the rhesus monkey, average of 10.4 from other mammals, 14.5 from reptiles, 18 from amphibians, 22.5 from fish. Then, this is an accurate reflection of the generally accepted evolutionary sequence of fish to amphibian to reptile to mammal. Ta-da. That's it. One goes, man, that's pretty good. I mean, yeah, if they've got data like that, then we must be out to lunch. Well, there's a different way of looking at the same data. Remember my earlier drawing. If we take that exact same data and tabulate it the exact same way, but draw little boxes here around animals of the same class. So we put mammals up here, birds down here, then fish, and so on. We see a little bit slightly different structure to the data. What's interesting here is that the lamprey, which is supposed to be a very, very primitive pre-fish animal, is equidistant from other fish, as it is from reptiles, as it is from birds, as it is from mammals. Okay, and remember they were saying that this thing here is, the sequence they were getting was by going this way down, comparing to humans, but if you take one of these earlier forms and compare it to other ones up the chain, it's equidistant from it. Again, fish here are all basically about the same difference from reptiles, pigeons, and so on, reptiles and birds. Yeast, for example, 46 to 40% difference in their amino acid sequence in cytochrome C from plants, from insects, from fish, from reptiles, and so on. What you see here is what we would call typology. A plant is equidistant among plants, they're all very closely related, but when you get out of the plant family, it's equidistant from any other life form. And just to look at the data from that standpoint, what we see, this is the lamprey sequence here, using hemoglobin, which is common to these animals instead of cytochrome C, find the same thing. Basically, it's between a 75 to 80% difference in the hemoglobin amino acid difference between the lamprey and fish, amphibians, birds, and various types of mammals. So what Denton says here, and I think this is right, there's not a trace at a molecular level of the traditional evolutionary series from cyclostome to fish, amphibian, to reptile. In fact, man is as close to lamprey as our fish. This is what you would expect to see in a typological thing, where animals are in distinct classes from each other, but there's no transition from one animal to the next animal to the next animal. So that's what the protein data seems to be showing. If we look at the cytochrome C again, we'll see that a fish is about 13% different from mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians. And again, that sequence that we saw earlier doesn't really hold up. Amphibia is traditionally considered intermediate, between fish and other terrestrial vertebrates. In molecular terms, they're as far from fish as any group of reptiles and mammals. So the whole idea of viewing this thing as a transition isn't there, because its proteins are as different from the things below it as they are from the things above it. That is the real weakness with the data. Now, how does the evolutionary camp respond to this analysis of the data? What they'll say is this. They have what they call the molecular clock hypothesis. What they do is, one, constructs a tree in which we look at this increasing percentage difference over time. And so what happened was, is back here there was some common ancestor which split into two different animals. The one became man, the other one became lamprey. And as this enzyme down here went up the chain, it changed at the same rate independent of which ladder it was climbing up. Okay? That's how they get around this. You say that while this one went up here, it changed by 8 amino acids, and while it went up here, it changed by 8 amino acids as well, and so on down the line. But as this thing branched, although they were in different animals, they were changing at the same rate, independent of that animal. That's the only way they can explain that typological arrangement to the amino acid structure. What they end up with are family trees that look something like this, where, again, they have these hypothetical life forms here down inside the tree someplace, but all the animals that are actually being tested are pretty much up here along the top of the umbrella, you might say. And the conjectured forms, which is where we'd really like to have some evidence, are only generated by a computer who is working with this algorithm of it branches and it changes at the same rate as it goes up these individual branches. Now, again, what they're assuming there is this very dangerous thing that once each line splits, those changes are occurring at a uniform rate. And that rate is independent of the replication time of the animal. See, there's various mammals that replicate at rates thousands of times different. There's mice that reproduce in 6 weeks. There's humans that take 20 years. There's elephants that go for, 30 or 40, something like that. There's insects. There's the cicada, which goes for 17 years. And there's the fruit flies, which go in a couple of weeks in terms of a replication rate. And yet, insect proteins are more similar to each other than insects are to mammals and things like that. So you have this problem. If you're saying that they're changing at a uniform rate, you can't take into account the rate at which that animal reproduces. And that's the major time when DNA is going to change if it's going to change. So they've got a large problem there. As a matter of fact, they've shown just fairly recently here at this thermoelectric clock idea that the same protein will change at different rates in different species of animals within the same class. So you have different insects with the cytochrome C, and yet it's changing at a different rate within the insect class. So what's happened here is basically this whole model of explaining this problem has fallen to the ground here in the past couple of years. There's a big gap there. How are we going to explain this data? It works very well within a class of birds, say, that you can follow changes in development of new species. But when you go to make the big jumps, it falls apart. And that's a major problem with it. Another glaring problem with it is what they call the living fossils. Go back to that lungfish. They're saying that thing's proteins have changed at the same rate as human proteins over the course of evolution, yet that lungfish looks the same over 200 million years of its proteins changing their amino acid structure. And yet, the line that became humans, that went 200 million years, has done all these changes in appearance and development of new organs and things like that. So, there's a very severe problem that they run into with the, what you call, these life forms that appear and stay stable for hundreds of millions of years, while other life forms are changing. Okay, I'm running out of time, so let me skip quickly here. Let me jump to B. other than these limitations to microevolution, there's some other problems that we're working with as well with macroevolution. That's a problem of the coordinated system. That's an organ where you have a whole series of cells that are specialized, they're doing a very particular thing for a very special purpose. It's difficult to change a coordinated system with a single mutation at a time because of this fully functional intermediate problem. In other words, if you're going to go from a fish heart to a reptile heart and add chambers and change your valve arrangement, you've got to go from a fully functional heart, that animal has to have a beating heart the whole time up the chain. And if you're changing that one mutation at a time, it's difficult to think of how that could have happened. Now, biologists is kind of stuck for what are the mechanisms by which we went little steps at a time to make these large changes in an organ. What you have going on is what they might call an island of function. They have a very distinct heart structure and another very distinct heart structure, and you cannot easily bridge the gap between the two with a transitional form, yet once you have that basic structure, you can vary its size and some of the other things that it has to it. For example, with birds, you have the very specialized organs of feathers, specialized lung structure and bones that are specially adapted for that thing to be able to fly well. But one of the things that's interesting to me as a biophysicist here is the flagella, the little things that make bacteria swim around in water. Over the past 10 years or so, they've figured out the basic structure of how flagella work. And if this isn't a coordinated system, I don't know what is. Now remember, this is bacteria that have been around for a few billion years. Turns out, this is a bad reproduction of the electron micrograph that shows it, and this is a fairly honest artist drawing here of it, what's going on. Bacteria have the only known rotary motor that occurs in nature, and that's what drives a flagella, a very primitive feature to have in a bacteria. What they have anchored in the cell wall is the anchor proteins, which are also bearings to allow a shaft to go through that bearing and keep in cell nutrients and things like that from leaking out. So we have a seal, a bearing, and an anchor in the cell wall contrived of proteins. The basic shaft up here is the rotor part of the motor, which is what part turns and is driven by, I think it's ATP. So this thing, when you give it ATP, actually steps like a stepping motor, or like a platen on a typewriter, and turns and drives a universal joint, a flexible series of proteins, and then the filament, which is the long, straight, hair-like thing, which is out there in the water. So here's this very primitive thing out there in simple bacteria, yet it's a very coordinated system. I mean, how can this exist without a universal joint to give that thing the flexibility to allow the cell to turn and things like that? How can you have bearings there that don't leak? How can you have, you know, one thing without the other? And then, of course, it's reversible as well. That if you feed it the right thing, it will turn the other direction. It turns out that ability to reverse is what the animal uses for changing its direction. But once you go forward, it spins. I forget if it's clockwise or counterclockwise. Goes forward. If it stops and spins it the other way, it twitters, and that allows it to change its direction. So here's this coordinated system in a simple bacteria that's been around for billions of years, and yet it's hard to say, now how did this thing first form? What's the protoflagella here that first started out? Was it a real short thing, but then it wouldn't move the cell? Was it a rigid thing, but then it couldn't have turned? It's hard to look at this thing and say, now how did this thing develop from nothing? If you have something there, you can change it, but to develop it from nothing is tough to do. That's the coordinated system problem that you're working with evolution. The type of thing that one has to evoke for this is called by some people pre-adaptation. That an animal develops a system like that in its spare time before it needs it. Okay, that there's no selective pressure on it at all. It's totally neutral whether it's there or not. But then some emergency comes in that, boy, it's real happy. It just happened to have that extra $20 in the wallet or something like that. That allows it to swim away. This whole problem of pre-adaptation is like, goes against the whole evolutionary thing of random chances and survival of the fittest, because How are these systems being selected and developed before they're used, before they're even needed? How do you get selective pressure developing these things? So this is the type of problem that we're working with evolution, and trying to come up with models for explaining how we can get these systems there. Very quickly, another problem that we have is the accumulation of information in the genetic material of the cell. This is where Dr. Newman can speak to this much better than I can. But the basic thing here is that it's hard to accumulate information by random chance. You can't have monkeys sitting around typing Encyclopedia Britannica by random means. That type of system doesn't really happen. Further, from the biological standpoint, DNA and RNA, the stuff in the cell for making it, telling the cell what to do, looks more like a system for preserving information, not for generating it. What I mean there is we're basically working with a system that's a tape recorder that makes tapes of itself, that's what the DNA is, running in a cassette player that makes a new cassette player. But there's never a record function on that cassette player. Okay, it can make new copies of itself, and it can make the machine that plays those copies, but to make a new tape, to invent a new group, musical group, and make a new tape or something like that, isn't built into the basic machinery there in the cell. So from that standpoint, there's a basic problem for it. So to wrap it up, I'd say, why is it then, given these manifold problems that it can bring up, why is it that evolution is believed? And I think the first reason, and this is something we've got to keep in mind, is that microevolution is true. And that part of evolution has been demonstrated. And what most people do is they will assume then that this jump to macroevolution is possible, or at least feasible. And that's what I've been working on, to show that is not a reliable jump to be making. But that, is the first problem that we come up to work with. In fact, this jump here from micro to macro might be called an effect of leap of faith. We've got one mechanism that we know works. Now we're assuming that everything on Earth arose by an extension of that same mechanism. And in fact, that faith aspect of the model is something which some of the people recognize. This is a quote from Aldous Huxley, who was, in the early part of this century anyhow, one of the very severe one of the persons who really used evolution as a club to beat Christians with. And yet, in his book, Ends and Means, he says that makes the point that there's probably no argument by which a case for theism or any other thing of that nature can be convincingly proved. Basically because you can't pull in laboratory-type evidence to prove something like that, it seems. And final conviction can only come to those who make an act of faith, to go beyond what evidence we have to a certainty. But it may be doubted whether this particular act of faith is intrinsically more difficult than those that we make, for example, every time we frame a scientific hypothesis, even valid ones. But there's an extension there that we do from going from, okay, this thing seems to work, to saying, this is the way nature really is. That jump is an act of faith, which a scientist does, and which Christians do, and it's something which, in evolution, they're doing even more strongly, because the jump between a microevolution mechanism and a macroevolution mechanism is so great. So there's a faith aspect there which is being made, and I would say, which system requires the less faith? A Christian model which says that there's a God out there who's involved in designing this, or the idea that it all happened by chance? In the end, which one requires less faith to hold to? And I would say, of that leap in the dark type of faith, where we're just kind of betting against the odds, that it's the Christian model that works out better. The other reason why evolution is believed, and I think this covers most people who aren't trained scientifically in a sense, is that most people accept what they're taught uncritically. You can't go back and rediscover the wheel, reinvent the wheel, and do know, if you become a total skeptic about everything your teachers tell you, you'll never get out of the sandbox. So, you know, this is a reasonable thing to be doing most of the time, but we have to realize it has limits. And we have to realize that there's people out there who hold evolution just because they haven't thought it through, they haven't heard a mechanism from the other side to explain it that explains the data that evolutionists would have. So, the uncritical aspect of it. For a scientist, however, the stumbling block that you get there is that no other explanation other than evolution is considered scientific. The problem here is in the definition of science. What most scientists would say is that science is a system where we try to find a naturalistic means to explain the phenomena that we observe around us. What is often done is they will stick the word purely naturalistic means in front of it. Okay? That means we don't care how improbable that naturalistic explanation is, as long as it's a purely naturalistic explanation, we'll be happy with it. That the purely naturalistic one would be scientific, no matter how improbable it is that it might have happened. Because if we have to evoke God, we're no longer doing science because we've gone beyond naturalistic explanations. That's dangerous science, because science then becomes a game to explain away God. Instead of something where we say, let's find out how God has made the universe and how we can use that knowledge, that becomes a game, you know, it becomes a philosophy in a sense to explain away. So that's a thing to recognize when talking with someone in science, is what do you basically mean by science? Is there a realm where science is going to not be valid because you're getting beyond these purely naturalistic explanations? So that's a problem to recognize with it. That it's a wrong definition of science that they're probably working with. By the way, when you're working with liberals and the JEDP theory, you find exactly the same thing. When it comes to textual criticism, I had a professor who shot all kinds of holes in the multiple documentary hypothesis. When he was done, he still held to it because he said it's the only scientific model to explain the origin of the Old Testament. He's falling for exactly the same thing. It's the only purely naturalistic explanation you can have for it. Therefore, although it's terrible, I'll hold to it. You go, oh, wow, I can't believe this. But that's the kind of thing to be watching out for in people's approach to doing heavy thinking about a subject. Are they turning it into a game to get God out of the picture? Are they really trying to see what's really there? I would say science is the goal to see what is really going on. If that includes God, great. If it's a series of natural laws that he's established, that we don't have to have him doing miracles every instant to keep something going, well, that's great too. So that's, the basic approach we have to keep in mind. Another problem with evolution is that it's very difficult to disprove it. It's the type of theory that can explain just about any observed phenomena that is handed to the model. The most striking thing of this that I've come across is what they call convergent evolution. When they study eyes in early life forms, what they call early life forms, they see that an eye shows up in say, a fish-like animal, and then it shows up over here in a clam-like animal or something like that, and they say, now, how could this eye show up here in a clam and here in a fish when there's no evolutionary pathway between these two animals? So what they'll say is that, well, that eye evolved independently in these two animals twice. Okay? It needed an eye. The clam decided it needed an eye, and the fish decided it needed an eye, so it did the same thing twice. And these two independent forms have eyes now. That they call convergent evolution. And there's some guys that have said, wow, isn't it amazing? The eye has evolved in nature 40 times in different animals. And I look at it from the physics standpoint and say, man, if you've got to evoke 40 independent occurrences of this very structured and impressive organ called the eye, 40 different times, you've made it 40 times less likely that evolution has occurred than my thinking. And yet, they'll say, well, the fact that it has happened 40 times is proof that evolution is true. You got it. Oh, wow. So there's that problem that it's a very powerful model. It's too powerful in that sense. You can't easily disprove it with data because it can be some rational explanation can be found for why that might have happened. So that's a dangerous thing with the model itself. And lastly, and this isn't everyone's reason, okay, don't go accusing your biology professor or something that he really holds to evolution because he has an immoral lifestyle and things like that. But among many of the thinking philosophers who are really driving hard for evolution, that I think is one of the reasons for it, because it gets God out of the picture. It means man is here by meaningless chance, and there's no one over us that we're responsible to, and therefore we can do what we want. And again, to show Aldous Huxley, again, is one of these men who really drove hard with the theory of evolution against Christians with it. He actually tells us this. He says, "For myself, it's no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness, which is what evolution basically boils back to, is essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desire was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system." Okay, now that system was capitalism, because, you know, he wasn't on top. And therefore, you know, if we're not on top, then it must be a bad system. So liberation from that system, and also liberation from a certain system of morality. The objective to the morality, because it interfered with their sexual freedom. The objective to the political and economic system, because it was unjust, i.e., you know, we weren't rich and blow off up on top. So that's a driving force, again, not in everybody. There's, you know, I would say most people in the hard sciences would be evolutionists because they think the data supports it. But from the philosophical standpoint, it's a tool of liberation. It frees them from the idea of a God, from the responsibility to a God, and you can go out and live how you want. And that is a very powerful thing to have in a philosophy that looks like it has some scientific backing. And that's one reason I think evolution has really gone so well. So in looking this over, what I'd like to encourage us all with, what I encourage myself with, is something which Robert Dick Wilson has said, and Dr. McCrae has this down in his preface to the book, is Higher Criticism Scholarly. Basically recalls Robert Dick Wilson is saying that a Christian scholar should approach his material in the following way. That he should build solidly, very thoroughly, never be satisfied with superficial answers, because God's word can stand the most thorough investigation, not to shirk the difficult problems, to seek to bring the facts to light, for God's word and God's world will never contradict one another. And that's an important thing to keep in mind when we're looking at evolution. When we're looking, you know, in the natural sciences and the way the world is. We have the Bible, which gives us God's word. We have the creation, which shows us about the Creator as well. If we're understanding these two sets of data correctly, they shouldn't contradict each other. We might have to fine-tune our interpretation of natural data. We might have to fine-tune our interpretation of biblical data. But in the end, the two should not contradict each other, and we've done a thorough investigation. So we don't need to be afraid, then, of the facts that the evolutionists would throw at us, that their model is true, because if they're understood properly, they should agree with God's word. So this is, I think, you know, the good approach for us to be taking in looking at this subject and looking at biblical studies as well, where, again, an evolutionary model has been injected into the idea of how we got the Old Testament. But in the end, the two shouldn't contradict each other.